Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Unless you're a complete recluse, you probably use your voice many times a day, whether talking to your spouse, chatting with coworkers, or singing along to music in the car. Yet, you've probably never thought all that much about something that's literally happening right under your nose. My guest today says that once you do start thinking about your voice, it reveals fascinating secrets to who you are. His name is John Colapinto, and he's the author of This Is the Voice. John and I begin our conversation with what exactly the voice is, how the voice develops in babies, why men and women speak in lower and higher voices, and what each sex finds attractive in the voice of the other. We then discuss why people develop accents and how these accents set boundaries as to who is in and who is out of a group. We then dig into the modern phenomena of vocal fry and up doc and how, when you end everything in a question, it can sound like your submissive supplicant. We get into how singing makes us feel super vulnerable and why modern pop music can sound soulless when its inherent imperfections are stripped out. We enter conversation with the way our voices degrade as we age and John's call to own and use your voice. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/thisisthevoice. John Colapinto, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So you are an author of a new book called This Is the Voice, where you explore the human voice, the physiology of it, the history of it, the culture of the human voice. What caused you to take a deep dive into the science and anthropology of our voice?
Yeah, it was in some ways a long time coming. I think I really needed the initial spur of 20 years ago injuring my voice in a permanent way. I was actually at the time a staff writer at Rolling Stone magazine. Jan Wenner, the owner and editor, was putting together a rock band. I was tapped to be the singer because it got around the offices that I could at least hold a tune. But I had never done proper vocal warm-ups. I didn't know how to rehearse. I oversang horribly, like way too loud at rehearsals. And the gig itself was scary, 2,000 people, lots of celebrities in the audience. And I sort of overdid it there as well. And ended up with this rasp in my voice, which was eventually diagnosed by a laryngologist, as they're called, as a vocal polyp. And it's effectively like a bleed in one of your vocal cords from overuse that becomes like a bump of scar tissue on one of your vocal cords. So that got me thinking, you know, all of a sudden I couldn't take my voice for granted, couldn't sing anymore. But actually, 10 years later, when I did a story on a vocal surgeon who had saved Adele's career, she had a polyp much like mine. He was the guy that said to me, you know, this is messing you up more than you're acknowledging. Like, you are limiting your emotional range because we do emotion in voice with pitch changes up and down. And he said, you're speaking in kind of a one register in order to sound a little smoother. You know, you're not projecting who you are because you're sort of coming across as this raspy voiced, like bourbon swilling cigarette smoker, which I'm not anymore and haven't been for years. So, you know, he put it in my head that even something as tiny as a little bump on one vocal cord is changing how you behave, how people perceive you, how you sound. I mean, I stopped speaking as much. I'm an extrovert. I stopped talking as much because I would be extra raspy. And this really was the beginning of thinking about writing a book that really looked at the whole wide scope of what our voices are doing that we don't really acknowledge.
All right, so this is going to sound like a really basic question, but I actually, sure. This is really profound. What exactly is our voice? What is
that's the $64,000 question. Absolutely, because we just assume, oh yeah, voice. I mean, it's right under our noses, literally. But we don't think about the fact that it actually is a signaling and communication system that is transmitting emotion, but also, of course, language, the linguistic layer. It's telling people something about where we come from accent and so on. It can even communicate sexual orientation if someone has a very strongly gay voice, as in the guys in whatever it's called, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy or something. But you know, it's not enough just to talk about what the signal is doing. When you think about how we're doing it, you suddenly realize, wait, there's no single vocal organ. I mean, the vocal cords just create a buzzing sound, that we actually then have to sculpt into speech by moving our articulators, lips and tongue. But we're actually powering the vocal cords with air that we're pushing up from our lungs. And, you know, we take that for granted, but chimpanzees can't do it like we do. We have to draw out our exhalations. We actually hold back in order to breathe like out for a long time to string words together. chimpanzees go hoo, hoo, ha, ha, because they can just do little short bursts. So we're actually, it's like all these different body parts are acting to create this signal that is so complex. So, I mean, what is the voice? Who is it singing? Is it just talking? Is it coughing, laughing? It's all of the above.
And it's not just physiology. It's like it's a cognition. It's a mental, it's like in the mind as well.
Oh yeah. It's, I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, it's all, everything that I just described is of course controlled by our brain. And, you know, we don't think of it this way, but speech, talking is a physical gesture. I mean, you're literally moving body parts with exquisite control and precision and hitting targets in your mouth with your tongue tip, either to say a T or with the back of your tongue to say a K. I mean, the stuff that we're doing that's just, you know, motor control, again, is all controlled by the brain. But then we've got that layer, you know, that high executive cortical layer that's giving us language too. So we're putting together words and, you know, putting thoughts into words, which we then get out through our vocal apparatus. So there is so much going on up in that brain of ours with voice.
So let's go back, kind of hash out some more of the physical aspects of voice. You know, humans are the only animals that can speak with a voice. Why can't our, you know, primate relatives, what is about their physiology that's preventing them to have a voice?
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. It's a combination of exactly as you say, their physiology. It's literally where their larynx, which is the thing that holds our vocal cords, it's like the voice box. And men can see theirs because it's where the Adam's apple is. That point is literally where your vocal cords join and then extend backwards towards your spine. But anyway, ours are about mid-neck. If you actually look at a chimpanzee, if you dissect one, you discover that its larynx and vocal cords are right up in the back of its mouth, just under the soft palate at the back of the mouth. What that does is it eliminates the sort of throat resonating chamber that we have. There's that vertical part of our throat that actually is, you know, acts to amplify sound and to filter it. And we actually do that also with our mouth. So that's how we do vowels, is where I'm going with this. And vowels are absolutely critical to speech. If, like a chimpanzee, you can basically only make the vowel sound which is about what they can do with the mouth chamber, you can't say a sentence like, who hid the hat in the hut, hud? So, I mean, you know, I'm just using an H and D pair of consonants, but I'm putting a different vowel inside each one and saying who hid the hat in the hut. Now, that's literally, you know, a major aspect of how language is even possible. So chimps don't have that, but they also lack the sort of parts of the brain, or at least as far as we know, actually, this is actually, I guess, something that we can never know for certain. They seem to lack those parts of the brain that comprehend words as sound, which they can then try to put out through their vocal apparatus. But, you know, again, yes, their bodies just aren't outfitted for speech.
I thought it was interesting. You highlight the point that having our larynx down lower actually makes us more susceptible to choking.
Yeah, that's an amazing, and actually Darwin was the first to notice that. Because our larynx is so low, it actually brings the opening to our lungs right beside where the opening to our esophagus or food pipe is. So every time we swallow, food has to pass across this very dangerous opening to our lungs, which is where our vocal cords open and close. And so people have been choking to death for centuries, you know, because of a mistimed swallow. The Heimlich maneuver has helped with that. But Darwin said, this is totally against everything I know about natural selection, which is supposed to increase our chances of living rather than increasing our chances of dying. And he saw that our larynx was lower. He just didn't know why. It was, you know, in the 1950s and 60s that people discovered that throat resonance chamber that I mentioned and its importance to creating vowels. And a wonderful linguist and scientist at Brown University named Philip Lieberman said, hey man, the reason that larynx, you know, is so low is it actually, yes, it increased the chances of dying, but it also improved or created our ability to speak, which just outweighed, you know, the dangers of choking. You know, evolution being kind of a balance between things that are advantageous and, you know, disadvantageous. being able to speak as a primate that could not run as fast as a leopard or wasn't as strong as a bear or whatever predator was there, our ability to speak was critical, not only to our surviving, but to shooting to the top of the food chain. Because by speaking to one another, we were able to make plans and we could outsmart these bigger, faster, more lethal predators. So the descended larynx, this larynx that literally moved down our neck over the course of evolution, was a surprisingly critical thing for our species.
And do we know about when that happened? Like, when did humans start using their voice? And then I guess that the question would be like, how did the act of using a voice change our thinking?
Yeah, well, you know, I guess it's believed about 500,000 years ago. We first had to stand upright from being primates that were knuckle-dragging, knuckle-walkers. And in standing upright, it's theorized that, you know, that partly is what started to literally pull the larynx down in the neck. Interestingly, though, it probably just continued to descend even before we had language. And that's because it gave an advantage in making us sound more threatening. When we'd make a deep voice like growl or grunt, because we have that throat resonance chamber, it actually sounds more threatening. And it's a size bluff. You sound bigger and more threatening. So it probably was offering an advantage to this rather weak and slow creature, this primate. But as we crossed over about 6 million years ago, when we departed companies from chimps and we started to become these human species, you know, it was really, again, about 4 to 500,000 years ago, it's theorized that the larynx was in a position that permitted vowels and that we had the motor control and speed of tongue and lip movement that gave us the ability to actually say stuff. How that affected our brains is fascinating. I mean, you know, this guy, Lieberman, who I mentioned, departs company from almost every other scientist on Earth at the moment who follows Noam Chomsky's idea that language began as thought, which in many ways is a bizarre thing to claim. Thought, not communication. I mean, as you pointed out, other animals have been communicating with their voices, you know, threats and mating calls and so on since time immemorial. We were obviously doing that in our primate past. The idea that language didn't evolve from like vocal sounds is sheer insanity. And Lieberman thought so. And he spent 50 years looking at how that descending larynx and various other changes literally to our genetic makeup, which they've discovered, was actually what created language. In a sense, language followed the voice in a feedback loop. I mean, it sounds weird. How would that work? Well, we're constantly feeding back into our brains through bodily movements, like with our hands and digits. That's how we started making fire and making tools. Our brains got smarter with more sophisticated abilities to move our bodies. That includes the vocal cords, tongue, lips. And in Lieberman's beautiful conception, which has been proved by a lot of genetic evidence lately, it's almost certain that language followed the voice. I mean, talk about not giving the voice enough sort of importance in the world of science these days. It's critical that we change our thinking on this.
Yeah, that was interesting. It makes thought a very physical act. Right.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And you know, and that too, Lieberman was kind of obsessed with, because he actually discovered that, you know, he sort of traced thought to the earliest movement of like mollusks and stuff with particular motor pathways. Now, on the one hand, that sounds totally bizarre. On the other, when you think about thinking, there's so much movement involved. You feel your thoughts go from A to B to C to D. You navigate through a mental space in order to assemble ideas. A lot of it happens unconsciously, but a certain amount, in fact, a lot of it is something that we actually feel as movement in our brains, I believe.
All right, so our voice changed the ways we think. It gave rise to language and allowed us to be, you know, Homo sapiens. Let's talk about how, on an individual level, like a baby goes from basically sounding like a chimp. They just can wail, wah, wah, wah.
Yes,
that's it.
Exactly.
To the point where, like, by year two, year three, like, they're saying full sentences. What goes on?
Yeah, well, stunningly, one of the things that goes on, maybe I'll start with them actually still in the womb. babies are actually learning language from the minute their hearing is in place. And that happens at about 28 weeks gestation as a fetus. They can hear their mom through their through her abdominal wall. But they also pick up a lot of her voice signal through what's called bone conduction. As she speaks, her whole skeleton and her musculature vibrates and it carries it down into that amniotic fluid that surrounds the baby. So that fetus is actually getting its first stimulus from a human voice that is vibrating against the soles of its feet, its legs, its neck, its face. So if you really think about it, we are absorbing language in this, like, as this captive audience. And what babies are picking up at that stage, they've learned, is the stress patterns of particular languages. We stress either a first or second syllable more often in English than in French and so on. So they're born with a basic, very basic understanding of how their language sort of sounds. It's not great just because it's kind of muffled in there. Once they're born into the world, they're suddenly in a bath of people speaking all around them. And they are, we've discovered through these incredible scientific experiments, actually starting to distinguish what the particular sounds of our native language are. We're born, science has discovered, able to hear every single sound in the world's 6,000 languages. That includes the pops and clicks of certain African tongues, and babies can distinguish between them. They can distinguish between R and L sounds, which are quite close in certain languages. And so they're doing all of this kind of constructing of the sounds, but then when they move to the part where they have to speak, at around 1 year old, when they start to they start babbling before that. The astonishing thing is they're born with a larynx that's in the same position as a chimp's, as we talked about. It's literally up at the back of the mouth because they breastfeed and they have to be able to breathe through their nose without coming up for air. And the milk flows around that raised larynx and into the stomach. But literally over the first 3 to 6 months of life, that larynx inches down the neck. They get onto solid food. Soon they're swallowing over the opening to their, lungs as well. And their larynx moves basically where an adult's is. It still has a way to go, but they start to be able to make vowels well enough that we can understand them. One other thing I can't resist mentioning that they have to do, we think we speak with a little space between each word, almost like words on a page. We don't. It's a constant ribbon of sound. Babies just hear that ribbon. How do they know where words begin and end? One way they know is by running a statistical analysis on the sounds that they're hearing. So if you're a Polish baby, you hear a Z and B sound together, like Zbigniew, the name Zbigniew. But if you're an English baby, you never hear that combination within a word. But you do hear it across a word boundary. If someone said leaves blow, you've got that Zb, but it's going across a break in the words. Babies listen for the statistical kind of preponderance of those sound and sound combinations. And they literally realize, I should split this. Because I'm an English baby, I'll split the words there. That's probably a word. And there's other techniques they use. Science is amazing in having discovered this, where they are figuring out what separate words are, and then they figure out what those words mean, and then they move into learning grammar, and eventually they're speaking.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's I-N-D-O-C-H-I-N-O.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, M-A-N-L-I-N-E-S-S. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn the art of negotiation from Chris Voss, we had him on the podcast, leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest, writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest, you name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the Masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this Masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss. Is 2024 bringing exciting or unexpected changes to your life? Face those challenges with more confidence and a great term life insurance policy. Fabric by Gerber Life makes it simple to protect your family's financial future. Fabric by Gerber Life was designed by parents for parents to help you get a high quality, surprisingly affordable term life insurance policy in less than 10 minutes. Fabric has flexible policies that fit your family and your budget, with quality policies like $1 million in coverage for less than $1 a day. You could go from start to covered in less than 10 minutes with no health exam required. There's no risk to apply, you have a 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can cancel at any time. I remember when my son was born, that was, man, we're coming up on 14 years, one of the first things I did was I got a term life insurance policy because I wanted to make sure if something ever happened to me, I knew my family would be okay financially. Join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to protect their family. Apply today in just minutes at meetfabric.com/manliness. That's meetfabric.com/manliness, M-E-E-T, fabric.com/manliness. Policies issued by Western Southern Life Assurance Company, not available in certain states. Prices subject to underwriting and health questions. And now back to the show.
And to hit back on this point of how our voice shapes our cognition, you highlight we have instances where there's like a certain period of time where a child needs to learn language, and if they don't, it kind of messes them up for the rest of their life. And there's that movie, that Jodie Foster movie, Nelly, right, where that happens.
Oh, yes.
So what happens to children who don't learn how to speak?
Yeah. You know, what happens is there's what they call a critical period or a window in earliest childhood where certain behaviors are learned then or they're never learned. So what's literally happening is the baby is building a brain that is capable of language by hearing language. I mentioned, that we're hearing the speech sounds of our particular language, b, k, a, a, e, I, o, u, and so on. With repeated hearing, the baby actually builds neural pathways, i.e. links together neurons in the brain that represent those sounds. And so if they keep hearing a p, puh sound, they literally, and it's interesting how this works, the electrical impulses that flash along the neurons actually build like a layer, sort of like on a copper wire, the insulation. It's called myelin. It's like a protein that's built along the nerve, which speeds up the way the neurons flash across each other and represent that puh sound. But if they don't hear puh, that connection dies away. They literally don't happen. So within that period, that critical period, you build a language capable brain that both hears the sounds and also builds the neural motor pathways for saying them, and also sort of the musical movement of language that links things in grammatical structures. And you sort of have this period where if you don't learn that stuff, you're not going to. And we actually know this in a way, because bilingual babies that are raised in bilingual environments, they effortlessly know French and English. But a baby raised just in English, if he, like when he goes to high school, he's got to sit there and go, je suis, tu es, il est, nous sommes. He's like learning by rote French and not learning it, because it's so damn hard to learn a foreign language when your brain has been sculpted for your native tongue. So that's literally what's happening.
But I think it's interesting too, it kind of raises the point, the question, like, what is the voice? Because like the children who are born deaf, they are still able to get that language thing going if they learn sign language. But I imagine like it follows the same pattern, except you're just using your hands.
Well, that's it. Because people do ask that. They say, hey, wait a second, if the voice is so important, but we have to remember that our species obviously is endowed with a talent, a special skill for language. If those sort of standard ways of communicating have been shut down by because of some malfunction in the hearing, yes, then you use another. I mentioned before that speech is a gesture. Well, hands gesture, of course. And it's astonishing and wonderful how human beings start to gesture with their hands. Deaf babies, they've discovered babble with their hands. They literally, in that stage before speech in a hearing baby is in place, but they're practicing by saying ga 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 ba 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 ba. You know, deaf babies are doing something similar with their hands. It's wonderful.
Right. So yeah, there's a voice there. Even if you don't use your larynx to make a voice, still have a voice.
I guess that's a good way of putting it. Absolutely.
So another thing you explore in the book about our voice is the difference between male and female voices. And you point out in humans are pretty much the only species where there's like dysmorphia, where there's a big difference between genders and how they speak and their voice. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. Men speak on average about a full octave below women, which is actually quite stunning. Because think of your dog or your cat or a bear, any mammal you care to name, you cannot tell them apart sexually. The dimorphism is, they're called monomorphic voices and species. We are a dimorphic species, and strongly so with our voice. And so that raises the question, why? Why on earth would that be? Why did the male voice go low and the female high? And I mean, the best that science can tell us at this point, and it seems highly likely to me, is to look at stuff that Darwin said, actually, about mating behaviors. And he pointed out brilliantly that, I mean, we're kind of used to this idea that mating is around this idea of attraction to the way the mate looks and sounds and moves and so on. So we think of a peacock with its feathers that seduce, and we think of a bird with its beautiful bird song. Now, with human beings, a female might be looking at a male and listening and realizing, oh, there's sort of a deep voice there. Now, voices are deep because of testosterone. It literally makes our vocal cords bigger and thicker and slower vibrating to give a lower voice. So over evolutionary time, females kind of figured out, oh, if he's got a deep voice, it means he's got a good steady shot of testosterone. He's probably strong and capable and as aggressive as he might have to be in order to win food for me and the baby. And furthermore, I'd like to pass that along to my baby. All good. But it's not the only way that our voices or how mating works, because there's also this thing called contest competition that Darwin talked about, whereby men, or the male of the species usually, have to fight each other for the favors of the female. And that also drove male voices down, 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 because as I mentioned earlier, a deep voice is a threatening sound. It can be just a bluff, or it can be, it can really mean business. Like, when the voice goes down there, people know, okay, it's serious. So one of the things that's super interesting is it's theorized that, females like a deep voice in men, but not too deep, because it means the man is over androgenized or over testosteroned. And that might mean that he's kind of, let's say, you know, like kind of rapey. Maybe he's kind of like trying to find mates on the side. Maybe he's not going to stick around to raise the baby. So it's theorized that human male voices sort of ended up where they are, which is low and lots lower than a female, but not as low as a gorilla, because females did not choose the super deep voices. And so a slightly more mid-range male voice was propagated in our species through reproduction. And that's how we have ended up where we are as males with these voices.
Yeah. And then you also say men, you know, there's also an attraction, like men are listening to the female voices for attraction. And I guess the two things are it's breathiness and like a higher pitch.
Yes. And I don't want to leave this out. I got in trouble on another podcast or possibly interview where I think people said, yeah, you didn't talk about women's voices. And they were right. I didn't get that opportunity. So I'm glad you've asked. Yes. I mean, it's again, theorized. We can never know for sure. But men through testing, like college-aged men, find the higher voice in a woman more attractive as a mate. They statistically say that's more attractive. And they also like a slightly whispery edge to the voice, or it's almost hard to describe what this sound is like. Now, the reasons why we believe is that the higher voice suggests that the person is fertile, because when women have menopause, their voices deepen. So a higher voice in a woman is suggestive of reproductive health. What's that whispery edge? Well, fascinatingly, at puberty, women's voices change in a particular way whereby the vocal cords don't quite meet fully at the back of the vocal cord. Our vocal cords make sound by vibrating against each other. Now, they have a little gap where some of the air from the lungs sort of whispers through in a slightly breathy kind of whispery sound. Now, if you think of Marilyn Monroe, she exaggerated both of those qualities. So she spoke in a Cupid doll high voice with a lot of whispery edge to it. So the feeling is that men are sort of, you know, subconsciously, unconsciously hearing these things in a female voice and being attracted to it. But I just hasten to add that all of this is very, very slippery, because of course there are women with deep voices that sound particularly sexy. I mean, Lauren Bacall, the actress from the 1940s, was sort of famed for her deep voice. So, you know, you always have to kind of weigh these theories against certain things that contradict them. But anyway, it's her voice actually had some breathiness. So who knows?
So another aspect, sort of a cultural influence on her voice, and I'm going to bring this up because I've been hearing it, a beaut, the Canadian accent.
Lovely.
Let's talk about that. Yes. So like, why do we have accents with our voices? Do we know why that happens?
Yeah. You know, it really is an astonishing thing. Accents are really like territorial sounds. They're almost like ways for groups of people to indicate their membership with each other and their exclusion of like an interloping other. And we know that from extraordinary studies by a guy named William LaBeouf. And he started in the early 1960s studying the fishing people on Martha's Vineyard, a tiny island off of Massachusetts. And there he discovered that these fishing families were, oddly enough, starting to speak with an accent that was many generations old. It sort of lingered in the oldest people, but all of a sudden, the youngest people were doing it. He didn't know why. He interviewed them. He did a sociological deep dive and discovered that really what they were doing was trying to differentiate themselves from the mainlanders from New York and Boston, the rich summer folk who would pull into town. And it so happened in this time in the 60s, the fishing families were going through a terrible economic crisis and they were losing their homes. They were having to sell them at fire sale prices to the city folk. And they were moving out of these ancestral homes built by their fishing ancestors and having to move into shacks on the inland. What this made them do was A, despise those folk and revert to an accent that not only said, hey, we're part of the storied fishing past of America that's in Moby Dick, for heaven's sake. This was the economy of America. We belong to that special group. Furthermore, this is our island. Now, this indicates that accents are kind of about pushing people apart from each other. And the guy that wrote Pygmalion or My Fair Lady, George Bernard Shaw, knew this. He actually said, an Englishman cannot open his mouth without making another Englishman hate or despise him. Here in America, I think we pride ourselves on being a democratic society that doesn't have a class structure as much. I'm afraid we do. You know, you have Northerners looking down on Southern accented people. You've got flakes out in California speaking in Valley Girl sounds. You've got Midwesterners with their Marge Gunderson from that Coen Brothers movie way of talking. I mean, all of these differentiations are about saying, I belong to this crowd, or I don't belong to that one.
No, it's true. I lived in Mexico for a few years. And even within Mexico, there's differences. There's like regional accents. So you could tell if someone was from Mexico City or they're from Sinaloa or they're from Veracruz. And then even within the Spanish-speaking world, there was a lot of like, I don't know, like sort of, you know, like in Spain, they speak with like a lisp.
So oh, yes, I've heard of that. Sure, right.
So saying like sábado, be a sábado. And like yes. Mexicans, like, they make fun of that. And then like the Spanish, like they make fun of the Mexicans. They're like, you're not speaking true Spanish.
Yes. Well, and the amazing thing is that these things do become essentially hardwired in childhood during that window that I talked about, that sort of critical period. And it's why I say, out in a boot, or however I do it, I can't even imitate it, you know, because I'm unconscious of doing it, but people hear it. So yeah, these things are get really cemented in very early, and you've got to work hard to get rid of an accent.
And it's weird how like things can develop. You talk about the development of that sort of Chicago accent, right? You know,
incredible. SNL.
Yeah, the Bears, the Bulls. And like you think that's how they've always spoken Chicago. But this one guy dug into it and is like, no, it actually wasn't like the 1960s that people started talking like that.
It's absolutely stunning. It was actually that same guy that did the Martha's Vineyard study. He actually he looked at why people in that entire Great Lakes region spread out across the sort of northern middle part of the country, they've been increasingly saying not fat and the name Anne, fat Anne, they're saying Fiat Ian, you know, and like they're speaking in this really distorted way with their vowels. So he looked at why, and he literally traced it to the migration of people in the mid to late 1800s from upstate New York area when the Erie Canal, of all things, was built. They were suddenly able to people that part of the Great Lakes region. Now, when they moved in there, they encountered another group of people who were upland Southerners from places like Kentucky. Now, it so happened that these groups had totally different approaches and values to life in almost every respects, from drinking to whether or not stores should be open on Sunday to whether or not women should have special rights. The Northerners were kind of like PC millennials of today. They were very sort of liberal. Now, the Southerners were kind of, they were into capital punishment. They were, you know, they were just more loosey-goosey about a lot of stuff. So you had this incredible culture clash. Now, how did it manifest? As they became more acutely sort of aggressive towards each other, the Northerners thought, hey, I don't want to sound like them at all. And they actually began to exaggerate that A sound in the word fat, let's say. And they started to push it forward in the mouth. The tongue went higher. Fat to fet, to fiat, to fiat. And over time, literally, and into the 60s, this was still evolving. Because, of course, the political divide has gotten no less. In fact, it's gotten probably stronger. And you literally had the Northerners pushing the vowel forward, while the Southerners, I really believe, in response, they dropped the tongue back. They started to give it a nice drawl, you know, fiat. Like, you know, why? I'm not going to say fiat. So you had these Americans pushing themselves apart with their voice, but also politically, socially, and in terms of values. I mean, this is how deep voice goes as an indicator of like mass sort of movements in American society or in the world. It's just fascinating, I think.
Well, you mentioned one sort of accent that's it's new in America, and it's the Valley Girl type thing. It's called uptalk. Most people talk about uptalk. And the other one, they typically, when you hear people talk about uptalk, they are also talking about vocal fry. For those who aren't familiar with these concepts, can you describe what vocal fry and uptalk is? And has anyone studied like why are younger people in the United States speaking with vocal fry and uptalk?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting now, you know, uptalk is when people end their even statements with a set, with a question, as if they're always asking a question. And so they, you know, they say that they're going to go to the store because we're, and right now we're talking on a podcast.
Yeah,
so that's uptalk. The vocal fry is this growly sound that you'll notice young women, largely you tend to notice it in young women, but older and older women are doing it, where it's almost a crackly sound of the voice and it's kind of like down there. I wish I could do it better.
Yeah, like this.
But exactly.
It's like Kim Kardashian talks with a vocal fry. Yeah,
totally.
Yes, hello.
And you were asking, has anyone looked at where it came from, why it's become sort of this epidemic amongst American and Canadian women? And the belief literally is that it can be traced to the popularity of the Kardashians TV show, which started in 2007, but peaked in its popularity in 2010, which is exactly when linguists became fascinated. They were like, why is every young woman talking this way? Now, I wrote about this in the book, and I theorized at first that women were doing it, particularly at that period, 2010, shortly after the big sort of economic crash of the subprime mortgage meltdown, where all of a sudden millennials' lives didn't look too easy. It was a fearful time. Kim, however, was a pampered Beverly Hills billionaireess, or whatever she was, millionaireess, who had not a care in the world. And she spoke in this way that kind of erased all emotion from her voice. Because vocal fry, you can't go up and down. You always sound like you're kind of bland and blasé and in control. So my initial theory was that women were quite understandably kind of disguising any anxieties they felt about the future and about life in this imitation of Kim. But the thing is, it's gone on way too long. It's still accelerating in the world. My new belief is that initial use might sort of morphed into something else after the 2016 election, where you had the rise of the Me Too movement, and you had women now with a sort of newly energized feminism that really derived from a feeling that the government was being run by people that were inimical to women and their rights. So suddenly the vocal fry became really an assertion, a growl, a way of women to say to men, I really mean business. And in the book, I point out that in the 70s, we had, you know, I am woman, hear me roar. But that roars are kind of theatrical. But a growl is actually something that's kind of, it's across the animal kingdom. And it's produced exactly like the vocal fry. It's the same set of laryngeal muscles. You actually tighten and stiffen the vocal cords. So the air moves through them in these crackling sort of bubbles. And so when a woman, my theory is doing that, I think she's sending a signal that I demand to be taken, not just seriously, but as a legitimate threat to you if you abuse me. And I think that might be why we're hearing the fry as much as we do in women. Men also do it, though, which is not often pointed out.
Yeah, dudes do it. And I've talked to a vocal coach about this, and he said when you see guys doing vocal fry, they're usually trying to make their voice deeper. Because
yeah,
they don't have
yeah.
But he says, yes, like, it's not great for your voice. It's not the best thing to do, because actually it just.
Yeah, they say it's hard on the vocal cords, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then the uptalk, I mean, why do you think these like drive people nuts? Like, so like,
oh, wow.
I mean, to me, it just bugs the crap out of me. Cause like, I don't know. Are you like making a statement? Or are you making a question? Like, what's going on
here? Oh, I can't believe that, Brett. Why does it bother you, Brett? No, it's so annoying. I mean, it's, well, you know what it is? It sounds defensive because, interestingly, you know, I mentioned before that we deepen our voice in order to sound threatening, but we raise our voice in order to sound submissive and loving. And we speak this way to babies and to pets just very naturally. We just do that. It's a reverse size bluff. We're trying to sound small. Now, a wonderful linguist named John O'Hala from Stanford years ago said that's literally why almost every language has a raised pitch at the end for a question. Because when you ask a question, you are literally becoming submissive to, you're giving up control and authority to the person you're asking the question of. So your voice goes up. Is it nice out? So you don't know, so you're becoming submissive. The person says, yes, it's really nice out. And they deliberately answer in a voice that does not go up, but down. So when someone is doing up talk, you really get the feeling that they're constantly asserting sort of a non-threatening, submissive, oh, I'm just like, you know, I don't know anything. I'm just totally at your mercy and you know everything. And that starts to grate. Now, you might sort of think, oh, gee, I guess I would kind of like someone that sort of makes me feel dominant and No, I think we prefer to try to work with people as equals if we're sane and normal. So someone that's constantly putting themselves in a position of sort of supplicating, questioning, submissiveness, you know, you want to slap them. One of the places it might have become so popular, and Labov said this as well, incredibly enough, was the song by Moon Unit Zappa back in the very early 80s, whose name is going to elude me, that song. Oh, I can't believe it. It's in my book where she raps in it too. Oh, well, she also does a little bit of vocal fry, but it goes way, way back to then, possibly. And then the movie Clueless picked it up, and that was a very popular movie. The girls there did it. Now, and that suggests too that like things in our culture are highly sort of contagious. The things about voice are very easily picked up as kind of fads, kind of short-lived fads, but then they can become like almost permanent aspects of accent as they get passed down to children when they're in the, you know, crib. So that might also be why we're hearing so much upspeak and vocal fry.
So we talked about too, when you speak, you're not just conveying information with words and language. Your voice itself can carry information about your emotional state. And it can be very subtle. It's not just like, I think everyone knows what a happy voice sounds like, a sad voice, but there's like these like really subtle ones like annoyed, you know, disdain, contempt that you can pick up on in a voice. So how do we know, like, have scientists kind of like figured out, like put an algorithm, like they know if they hear this voice, this is contempt? Like, do we know about that?
Yeah, great question. I mean, for years, decades, one particular scientist in the sort of, I don't know how many years, 40 years he devoted to it, trying to, you know, study emotion in voice. And think of how hard that is to do, because, you know, science, you want someone to be able to repeat a particular behavior so that you can be sure you weren't getting a one-off sound. So how do you make someone make a jealous statement that sounds jealous or envious or hostile or happy or sad or some weird blend of those emotions? So he figured out ways of doing that. He started using method actors, and actually that worked pretty well. And he, you know, scrupulously dissected the acoustic signal using instruments called a spectrograph and oscilloscopes. And this guy drew up these huge charts with like decimal pointed measurements of volume versus pitch versus the speed. Now you can imagine how incredibly complex that was, because it's literally those tiny adjustments. Now, the thing is that his work ended up being essentially worthless, because it was just like, who could do anything with this? But you mentioned a really interesting thing when you say, is there an algorithm? Because what the big tech companies are doing now is trying to imbue computer voices with convincing sounding human emotion. And the way they're actually doing it is not by using all those little micro measurements like this guy did, because you could never input all of that into a computer. They're using machine learning. They write an algorithm where the computer can teach itself, and then they play emotional speech into the computer with the emotions labeled, and the computer literally learns them itself. It's an astounding thing, and actually not a little bit scary, I have to say, because we've suddenly got computers kind of learning the way babies do. You know, I talked about how we sort of inculcate babies with speech by them hearing speech. Well, that's how our computers are getting so good at doing language, but now they're getting good at the secret ingredient of language that really makes us sound human, which is that emotional, what they call it, prosody. It's the song-like part of our voice. And if you don't use prosody, you become unlistenable. That was horrible what I just did. And if I kept it up, you'd have ended the podcast. So you've got to have the music. And yeah, I mean, you know, really, we don't know to, now here's the short answer. We don't really know what all those variables are, but computers are learning them anyway. It's amazing.
Yeah. Next time you ask your Alexa what the weather is, it's going to ask, John, you sound kind of annoyed. Did I
correct?
Do, that, right? Yeah,
that's exactly what they say. Or are you lying? You know, they might call you out on a lie. Man,
that's freaky.
This is where the nightmare could go.
That's creepy. Yeah, that's why I don't have an Alexa. God, no, don't do that.
Well, and those Alexas are going to start learning from your voice. I mentioned that because they're going to start putting that learning software into these devices that we use, Siris and Alexas and so on. And so every time we speak, when we call it up to say, hey, when's Justin Bieber's birthday? Something we all are curious about. You know, it's literally going to be learning some of the prosody of our language and speech from that.
Well, another aspect of voice that you hit is singing, right? That's kind of kickstarted the whole project. You were a singer, you got a polyp on your voice, on your vocal cords. What is it about singing that makes people feel really vulnerable? Like, why don't we like to sing?
It's so weird. It strips us naked. You know, it's this way in which, I mentioned in the book that if you could say to someone in a work environment, hey, you know, could you get up and like deliver this report? And they, even if they don't like public speaking, they could fumble their way through it. Try asking them to sing a solo song to all their coworkers. The minute you lift your voice out of normal speech and launch it into melody and rhythm, it strips us to our human core in a way that science doesn't really understand. We just know it when it happens. And it touches on emotions deep in us that are, maybe it goes back to our mums singing to us when we were babies, but I think it goes further back than that. Darwin thought that our language itself emerged out of the singing cadences of early primates. So it's almost as if, funnily enough, even though we exalt our linguistic capability, which I believe brought us to the top of the food chain, in a funny way, it's finally, though, that music where we find our most human kind of universal emotional salience. And to sing is to just totally bare ourselves kind of nakedly. And, you know, and that works in certain ways that can be so beautiful. And I do point this out in the book that when President Obama was addressing the Charleston church where there'd been a horrible shooting, many people killed, he started to speak and then he fell silent for 12 seconds, which is an infinitely long period of time to be silent. And when he next made a vocal noise, it was to start singing Amazing Grace. And someone just recently told me that I was correct, because he recently said that he had run out of words. There was no words for how horrible this was. And the only recourse was to singing. Now, in one of the world's greatest orators, Obama, that's quite an admission. So I can't really answer what that mysterious sort of soulfulness is, except to just say it's real, it's true, and it's a beautiful mystery.
Well, and going on to that, you talk about pop music today. One of the complaints, like some of it's like really complex and sophisticated, but one of the complaints that people have and music critics have is that it's too perfect, because we have this technology that allows us to take a singer's voice and auto-tune it, make it sound differently, put them back in pitch and like put things on beat. And when you hear it, you're like, that doesn't sound right. Doesn't yes. stir me. Like, what is it about the imperfection that stirred? Have you figured that out?
Yeah. You know, it's fascinating. A guy actually back in the 20s, the 1920s, studied singing voices and was actually amazed to discover that all singers, even highly trained classical singers, are singing off pitch very often, or starting off the pitch and then moving into the correct pitch and then moving out again. They're jumping on beats a little bit in advance or lagging behind in order to create like emotional effects. There's something called vibrato, where you're literally going between two notes, but it sounds like you're sort of on the pitch of one note. But if you think about it, you're not. You're wobbling. And these create emotion. Now, why on earth is that, you know, it's sort of like if you look at a painting, like a beautiful impressionist painting by Monet, you're going to see his brush strokes. And if you get close to the canvas, you'll suddenly realize, wow, that's kind of messy and that kind of looks wrong. You step back from it and it all assembles into something beautiful and alive. Japanese calligraphers with ink and brush pen, they love the little mistakes. They actually, they would put in mistakes into things that they made, because that's where we find our humanness. Now, the sort of quote-unquote mistakes in the human voice are absolutely real in singing. We almost we can't really control them. These emerge as part of the emotional expression of a singing voice, the voice trying to find a note. It's got a yearning quality of seeking the note, of seeking the thing that's going to unlock our emotion. And it's beautiful to hear the voice get there. Now, when you use Pro Tools to just center the person right on pitch and right on the beat, you're necessarily draining off a whole bunch of the humanity. And it's just, you know, it's just for real. And you can hear that, you know, listen to Bob Dylan, who's not auto-tuned, and he's not even a great like singer in terms of pitch and stuff, but he'll break your heart with certain songs. Taylor Swift, who was, you know, I think when she first broke, you know, I remember with the album Fearless, I saw her on Letterman. And she was very touching. And I remember thinking it was because she was kind of a lousy singer. She was a little off pitch, but she was singing about her first, you know, emotional affair as a young woman. And my God, like her being sort of not quite on the beat and a little uncertain in her pitches, it absolutely contributed to this entire beautiful emotional effect of vulnerability. Now she's a big stadium dance, you know, EDM singer, you know, with like propulsive beats and robotic sounds, and they're centering her voice on pitch, you know, with Pro Tools, and it's all gone. The emotion's gone. So she's a different singer now, a successful one, but she's not going to break your heart as readily.
Do you know, are there musicians who are kind of rebelling against the Pro Tools?
I believe they are. Yes, there are. But you know, I say that because they say it. I wish a name would come to mind, but you know, they kind of like to boast, you know, that they didn't use. But to be honest, you know, people do slide off pitch on like take 35 of the song that they're singing. And sometimes the engineer just nudges them, you know, onto the pitch. I mean, it's sort of irresistible. I guess the point is that it's irresistible. You know, with all of our computers now, you just know you can hit that button and get rid of the zit before you put the photograph of yourself up or whatever. I mean, do you really lay off that, you know, zit remover click? So I don't know. I should have asked some engineers this. I mean, whether or not anybody sings in their naked. I would imagine Dylan, but I don't know who else.
No, that's weird. Yeah, that's funny how we have that propensity to like want to remove our humanity. But then, yeah. But like once you do that with like Photoshop or like the audio tools, like you enter that uncanny valley and you're like, correct. This is not right. But like you still have the compulsion, I need to do it.
I know, exactly. I know, I want to be perfect.
Right. So you end the book, I thought it was interesting about how, what happens to our voice when we get old. And I never really thought about that. I was like, oh, I thought about going gray. I thought about getting wrinkly, but I never thought my voice would age as well, but it does.
Yes, it does. I mean, our, you know, sort of every component of voice that we talked about earlier, like everything from your lungs to your vocal cords to the articulators, lips and tongue, all of them basically degrade. They get weaker. They get less powerful. They get less precise. So you sort of hit the wrong tongue targets, you know, so your speech starts to sound a little blurry. But one of the biggest things that happen is that your vocal cords, it's sort of like your knee ligaments or something. They tighten up, they stiffen, they get arthritic. And so a young voice has a ripple, a beautiful, almost liquid ripple to the way the vocal cords vibrate and move. That goes away. They really become stiff and kind of crystalline and kind of hard. And you start to hear that in a croaky old person's voice. You know, the voices get more quiet because you don't have as much lung power as an old person. All of a sudden, the muscles are weakening and we sound loud by pushing that diaphragm. It's a big muscle. So all sorts of stuff happens. I mean, fat collects around the neck and literally makes the resonance chamber of the throat kind of smaller. Women's voices lower with age because their vocal cords gets kind of thicker and stuff. And men's kind of raise. So they, men and women, we talked about the dimorphism of male and female voices for mating. Well, when mating is no longer an option, you know, the voices actually move together. They start to sound more and more the same, men and women. So you're sort of de-sexed. Your power goes away. I mean, it's not pretty. And, you know, you really hear that in aged voices.
So what do you hope people walk away after reading your books? It's like you said in the very beginning, it's like, this is not a how-to book on how to sound like James Earl Jones or Frank Sinatra or whatever.
Yeah.
But what do you hope people walk away with?
Yeah, you know, I hope they end up with an impression of, I guess maybe two things, just how important our voice was to us as a species. I really do think it drove us to the top of the food chain. But I also do by talking about all the different things that control and make our voice, I hope that people will glory in their own voices, weirdly enough, a little bit, because, you know, it is an instrument. You know, you watch a wonderful clarinet player or saxophone player and you're impressed with what they're doing. When you just say pass the salt, you're doing something more remarkable in terms of speed of movement and precision of movement and so on, and even tune and pitches. So I would love to see people kind of, you know, push their voice out there, project it, you know, use your articulate, animate your voice, you know, get excited, sound enthusiastic, you know, possess the air around you with these vibrations, because we're not here that long. So I guess my feeling is I do sort of end with a little bit of uplift, because our voices are one of the main ways that we kind of imprint ourselves on the world that we occupy. It's part of the web that we extend in order to connect to everybody else. And you might as well give it some, you know, give it some power, give it some style, you know, speak up. Don't be shy. So I guess that's where I would go with that.
Well, John, this has been a great conversation. Where can people go to learn more about the book and your work?
Yeah, well, you know, you can definitely look at my Twitter, because I'm always tweeting Jake Colapinto. I'm always tweeting about it. But I mean, just read the book. I mean, it's on Amazon. You can get it at bookstores if you can go in them at this point with a mask on. And I actually do think I have to sort of rather hubristically say that my book actually pulls together all of these different strands and sort of disciplines to look at the voice in kind of this global way that frankly no other book really does or has done. That was actually one of the great challenges of doing it. You got books on linguistics, phonetics, singing, oratory, accents, but they're all separate books and separate fields of study. So for a book that, I mean, I really am selling it here, but for a book that kind of pulls it all together in a narrative way, you might just go to my book, This is the Voice. I don't know where else to point you.
Well, John, it's been a great conversation. Thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Brett, likewise.
My guest today was John Colapinto. He's the author of the book, This is the Voice. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Make sure to check out our show notes at aom.is/thisisthevoice, where you can find links to resources, where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM Podcast. Check out our website at artofmanliness.com, where you can find our podcast archives, as well as thousands of articles written over the years. And if you'd like to enjoy ad-free episodes of the AOM Podcast, you can do so on Stitcher Premium. Head over to stitcherpremium.com, sign up, use code manliness at checkout for a free month trial. Once you're signed up, download the Stitcher app on Android or iOS, and you can start enjoying ad-free episodes of the AOM Podcast. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. It helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or a family member who you would think would get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay. Remind you all to listen to the AOM Podcast, but put what you've heard into action.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
You can live out your MasterChef dreams when you find a professional on Angie to tackle your dream kitchen remodel. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.